Concerns about the MAX jet now impacting South Florida Flyers. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. From the studios of the Miami Herald in Doral, I'm Luis Hernandez. The FAA has grounded all 737 MAX 8 jets, this after two crashes of the model in the past 5 months, and it's impacting flyers in and out of Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Also, Miami lost out on hosting the Democratic National Convention in 2020, but what does the city really lose? And what does it take to be a genius? There's a new group called the Genius 100, and a local maestro is about to join today on Albert Einstein's birthday. Finally, the Puerto Rican restaurant on Biscayne, La Placita, turned a lot of heads when it painted a giant Puerto Rican flag on the outside of the building. It's been reported that the owners did not get the proper permits. We're going to hear from the folks of La Placita about what happens next. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. From the studios at the Miami Herald in Doral, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The Federal Aviation Administration has grounded all Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircrafts in the U.S. Other countries had made similar moves before us. And all of this comes on the heels of investigations into two recent crashes that have happened in less than 6 months with the same plane. Most recently was the Ethiopian Airlines flight that killed 157 passengers on board. Yesterday, President Donald Trump ordered all 737 MAX 8 planes grounded, and that impacted a lot of flights coming in and out of MIA and Fort Lauderdale. We're joined now by the Miami Herald's Rob Weil, who's been covering the story. Rob, great to have you, man.
Good to be with you, Luis. Thanks.
There's this huge pushback on the government because it took longer than other countries to do this, to ground this plane. Do we know why we waited?
It's a little unclear, but we do know that the decision took most of the industry by surprise. They had decided that they weren't going to do this until they had really serious conclusive evidence that there was a similarity between the Ethiopian Air crash and the crash that happened in October involving a Lion Air, which is a jet was owned by Indonesia. Apparently most of the industry figured that this wasn't going to happen. And even when Canada announced it early Wednesday, the word around the industry was still that this announcement was not going to come down. Then all of a sudden, they got conclusive evidence that there was a similarity between the two crashes that I mentioned, and at that point it became sort of impossible to do anything but issue the ground order.
And you talked, I mean, you had spoken with the airline, right? And they were talking about how they were assuring everybody that there's nothing wrong with the plane and the pilots are well trained, and then this evidence comes that the two crashes had similarities. I mean, what, you know, have they said anything since?
They haven't said anything since, and they would still maintain, you know, that they had full confidence in their planes and their pilots, which again indicates, I think, you know, the fact that this they were not prepared, I think, for this announcement. They were again until the very end they were saying, you know, we have everything under control, and you know, we don't need to make any changes.
And these two crashes are still being investigated. That could take months. I did want to mention too, by the way, that the Broward County mayor has come out saying that he wants to prevent these planes from going in and out of the Fort Lauderdale airport. I've read this is like the workhorse plane. It's a very popular plane. What do we know about it? It's relatively new.
It's relatively new, but it's the fastest selling plane that Boeing has put out. It's an updated version of the 737-800, which has actually been around since the late 1960s. The MAX version has a number of different new features. It's a little bit sleeker, can carry a few more passengers, and you know, Boeing is still the benchmark trusted name. So there were a lot of 737-800s out there, and they said, all right, this is the new version, so we'll take them.
And what is the thing about the similarity between the two crashes?
It's unclear. The language that's been put out has been a little ambiguous from the FAA about what exactly the similarities were. There was a agency, third-party satellite agency. They got some satellite footage in that led them to this conclusion that either the way that it had gone down or broken up was similar to the Lion Air crash.
And both of them, it was shortly after takeoff.
Correct.
All right. In the U.S., I mean, how many carriers use this plane, especially out of MIA in Fort Lauderdale?
So the two biggest U.S. carriers that use this are American Airlines, which obviously has a major hub here, and Southwest. Southwest actually has the most, the largest number of 737 MAX 8s. They have 28. But American, for our listeners here, Americans, all 24 of American 737 MAX 8s are actually operated out of MIA.
And you were telling me that this was just came down and it was nobody knew what was coming.
Exactly. So we even spoke with, and it had ripple effects sort of even beyond, you know, just flights that were on the MAX 8s, because all of a sudden, you know, you have the entire, you know, more than 2,000 people, if you calculate, 24 flights times, you know, about 150 people. So you have about 2,000 people suddenly trying to call customer service. Obviously, there's a lot more people, though, who need to check in. So it just sort of shut down the system for a good few hours yesterday.
And there's people that are leaving, but also flights that were supposed to come into South Florida. I'm talking with Rob Wild, reporter for the Miami Herald. Following the story again of the Boeing 737 MAX 8, these jets under investigation after two recent crashes that happened within 6 months of each other. Yesterday, the president ordering these planes grounded. Again, following the Ethiopian crash, and the investigations can go on for months. But how is this impacting people who are flying in and out of Miami or Fort Lauderdale? And, you know, we'd love to hear from you. You could find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Let us know if this has impacted you. Maybe it's, again, someone who's you're waiting for coming in from somewhere else, or you're flying out. And what do you know about these planes? What do you know about the planes that you were flying? How many do we know? Because you were telling me, Rob, about some of the flyers that are affected. How many do we know? You said a couple thousand possibly. And have they already, has that been resolved, or are there still people who are in the air about what's going to happen next?
There's still people who are in the air, if you will, about it. For instance, I spoke with a doctor yesterday. He said, well, they've rebooked me. He was some sort of platinum member. They've rebooked me onto a flight. He was flying from MIA to LaGuardia, New York. They said they rebooked me onto a flight to JFK for this evening, but I have no idea if and when I'm coming back.
You guys found, you and another reporter were working on this story, and you found quite a few people who had felt like they were stranded.
Yes, exactly. I mean, again, the fact that this, it was just reflective of just everyone being taken by surprise. It affected people just in all sorts of different ways of, okay, well, I made it to Miami, but am I going to have a return flight, or I'm stuck in some other place, and am I going to be able to get back? So it definitely affected, you know, thousands of people.
What are the airlines telling people as to what they should do if they expect to be flying out anytime soon? You know, again, just barely a day after this announcement, what's the best thing to do?
They're saying, you know, we're up and running. They're trying to put on a good face, but you know, the anecdotal stuff that we got is, if you have the means, you know, just look elsewhere, look for alternatives.
Wait, they're telling people to just go find another airline?
If they're trying to figure out their own schedule of, you know, how do we bring in new planes from different parts of the country to, if we can't use the planes that have been grounded, how do we coordinate?
This isn't as easy as just saying, like, we have some other planes that have been sitting in the hangar, so we can just bring them in?
Exactly, no.
Oh, gosh. So what, I mean, would we know about, have you heard from the airport, whether MIA or Fort Lauderdale, as to, you know, how this is going to affect their schedule for the next few days?
So this morning we learned that there are about 18 flights canceled, and if American has said that they're all in the process of being rebooked, but again, it's not clear. They didn't say how long that process was taking. So the direct number of flights that are being canceled is, you know, depending on your perspective, it's not a small number, but it's not shutting down things at MIA. But
if you think you're flying out, check with the airline, make sure you know how that's going to impact you and what you might have to do if you have to adjust. Rob Weil, again, reporter for the Miami Herald, covering this story. Rob, thanks much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still to come, why did the Democratic Party pick Milwaukee over us? We're going to discuss losing the DNC in 2020, coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Again, we are at the studios of the Miami Herald in Doral. Well, Miami will be hosting the Super Bowl soon. One thing they will not be hosting, the Democratic National Convention. This week, the DNC chairman, Tom Perez, announced that the event leading up to the 2020 election is going to be in Milwaukee. Houston was the third option of all the choices. So why did the Democrats choose Milwaukee over Miami? And what do we lose out, if anything, for not getting to host the event? Well, joining us now is Miami Herald political reporter David Smiley. David, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Oh, let me turn your microphone on. Sorry about that. You know what? First, let's start out. How did Miami end up in the top three? The final three, I should say.
We know that the DNC wanted Miami to be in the mix. You know, the Democratic National Committee puts out a request for proposals, and Miami was one of the cities that bid. Around the deadline, I'm told that Miami got a call from the DNC encouraging them to bid. So the organization wanted Miami.
Well, Miami pushed. People pushed really hard to get in, you know, to get. I mean, they were going everywhere and trying to entice.
Yeah, they really the committee involved, most of the committee involved, really wanted it in Miami. I think some people were maybe just going through the motions, but Miami. Look, for all of the obvious reasons, I think Miami's own brand of tourist luxury and its role in the state of Florida, which is really important politically, were some of the reasons why it got among the top three.
But it can't just be the sunshine. What were we selling? How were we trying to convince the Democrats this is where you want to hold the big party?
Well, that the idea that Democrats, whoever runs in 2020, can't become president if they don't win Florida. And if you're a Democrat, you can't win Florida if you don't do really well in South Florida, which is the sort of, you know, blue oasis of a Republican leading state at this point. So that was a big part of the pitch. And the other part was just, you know, Miami does a party better than anywhere else. And, you know, where do you want to party, in Milwaukee or Miami?
So the Democratic Party says, look, they picked Milwaukee because for values. And yet some folks in Miami said, no, it's personal. It was a personal reason for this.
Right. Tom Perez is, he married his wife in Milwaukee. One of his daughters went to college in Wisconsin. So there was a belief. And look, there were tons of rumors going around during this whole process, this very lengthy and drawn out process. And, you know, part of the word coming to folks involved with the bid down here was that, you know, people in the selection committee and in the DNC were pushing for Miami, and that Tom Perez really wanted to hold it in Milwaukee.
And so, look, I mean, Hillary Clinton won South Florida by a lot, even though Trump did get Florida. Trump took Wisconsin. So how much of it was, or at least the reasoning was, we need to go back to the Midwest. We need to win back those
voters. Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. Hillary Clinton really took for granted the Democratic hold on the Midwest. Probably the whole party took it for granted. Certainly by going to Milwaukee, I really do think making a point to tell the Midwest that, you know, the Democratic Party is there for you. We're there for the blue collar worker, for the people, the little guys who feel like they got a raw deal in the bailouts over the last 15, 20 years. That's, I think, a big part of it. It's also for the Democratic Party, they have to be concerned about an East Coast bias. They were in Philadelphia in 16. I want to say they were in the East Coast in 08. So they don't want to become the East Coast party. So that was part of it.
Do we count Miami as the East Coast?
I think geographically we still do.
Eastern Standard Time, maybe. Okay. You know what? I mean, what does it mean for Florida, you know, to not have the, well, Miami, but Florida in general for the 2020 election? Does it, not having the DNC mean anything for that, you know, for the election?
I don't know that it's really going to mean that much. The people involved with the pitch were certainly making the argument that the convention being down here would excite the base in Miami. I think presidential elections generally excite the base. Hispanic Democrats tend not to vote in large numbers in midterms, which is part of why Andrew Gillum lost the governor's race in November, but they turn out for presidential elections. Also, there are some people who thought that that the money that would have to flow from individual donors in Miami who do a lot of the heavy lifting down here in order to fund the convention would actually pull money away from the eventual campaigns for 2020. So there was some concern that actually having the convention down here would drain resources.
Well, we talk about money. I mean, does Miami lose anything not hosting it? I mean, it's a lot of people that would be down here. Isn't that part of the sell?
Yeah. Branding, you know, for the tourism industry, the summer is not a peak month. So you'd have, you know, roughly 50,000 media members and delegates who are going to be spending money and occupying hotel rooms. So yeah, that's certainly part of it. And I also think that there is for the city a desire to have the appearance of being you know, nationally important without doubt for politics in general.
Because the last time they hosted it was
72. Yeah, didn't go so well in 72.
And but they hosted the Republican and the Democratic convention.
Yeah,
that
that's right. A lot of protests. You know, I don't know if it was a contested convention. I can't. You know, I wasn't alive back then. But certainly not the smoothest of conventions for the Democratic Party. But yeah, generally not looked upon as one of the more successful conventions for either party, I don't think.
Talking with the Miami Herald reporter David Smiley, discussing the DNC's decision not to host the 2020 convention here in Miami. They chose Milwaukee. Smiley's also following the 2020 presidential election, which is now in full swing, even though we still have months and months to go. Former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz was in Miami, spending some time down here. What was he doing?
Well, he gave a speech at Miami-Dade College. They rented out a ballroom in the Wolfson campus downtown, and he gave his general spiel about how America needs to come together and how Republicans and Democrats are going to the right and left and causing extreme division, et cetera, et cetera. He also had some coffee at Vicky Bakery in Coral Gables, I want to say.
Okay.
With some moderate Democrats and Republicans, he wasn't the most high profile trip, but certainly I think trying to spread his message, particularly on college campuses.
And he's trying. I mean, because he sells himself as a centrist and independent, and he's gone after Democrats because he thinks they've gone way too left. But what does he stand for politically? What do we know?
Running to the center. Beyond that, I mean, that's his sort of 10,000-foot branding statement, but he's not giving a lot of specifics. He gave some specifics yesterday, which were kind of odd. I don't know who he was trying to talk to. He said he wouldn't nominate a Supreme Court justice unless they could get a supermajority of the Senate, which is kind of like saying he won't nominate a Supreme Court justice. And he said he wouldn't sign any legislation that didn't have bipartisan support. I don't know that those are things that are driving voters to like him or not. So they were kind of weird specifics to give out.
But he was trying to push the anti-socialism kind of view, which does well here because of the Latina community.
And I was waiting to see if he was going to say that, because he's talked about Democrats and feeling like they are moving towards socialism, which in some ways sounds a lot like Donald Trump or the Republican Party. And he did make a point to say that during his speech at Miami-Dade College. And I think, you know, if he does decide to run in the general election, that would be a problem for Democrats if he's coming down here campaigning on that idea.
So, I mean, look, we have a long ways to go, obviously, even before the convention. And there are more names that are jumping in. Obviously, some big ones that just recently have jumped in into the Democratic pool. But, you know, even though we're not hosting the DNC, as you said, Miami is still an important place. Democrats still want to come here.
Yeah, well, lots of money to be raised down here. And, you know, you have to run up the score in Miami-Dade County and Broward County if you want to be able to win in Florida.
But what about winning Florida in general when you look at how, I mean, see what happened in the governor's race. Mm-hmm. And it's been leaning more right than anything. You know, how are Democrats viewing the state in general?
It's still, you know, for the party, I think, a toss-up state, a very winnable state. You know, three statewide recounts in November, the U.S. Senate race, the governor's race, and the agriculture commissioner race. You know, within a fraction of a point in Florida, you win on the margins. So I do think the party still looks at this as a very winnable state. On the other hand, you know, someone has described Florida politics like Lucy holding the football for Charlie Brown, where Democrats keep getting so close and then Lucy pulls the football away and they lose by 1 point or half a point. And 4 years later, they still believe that they can win in Florida. So
who came up with that analogy?
I'm not. A reporter never reveals his sources.
There you
Lewis.
Go. Do we know of any other, you know, key Democratic presidential hopefuls who are looking to come down here anytime soon?
I have not heard about any other future visits. We just had Kamala Harris in here this weekend. Amy Klobuchar, a senator from Minnesota, was in Tampa. We just had Wayne Messam, the mayor of Miramar, sign papers to form an exploratory committee to run for president. So however a long shot he may be, we will have a local presence, at least for some time.
So apparently. Just to finish up and coming back to the losing out on the DNC overall, how are people, I mean, city leaders, the community in general, how are they feeling? What have people said?
I think they're past it. I honestly think that Tom Perez took so long to decide that everyone was just happy that he decided. There were some.
It was supposed to come out back in January,
right? Initially, he said January, and then he said February. And at a certain point, I think people started to feel a little bit like they were being strung along, and just sort of getting to the point of just wanting to have a convention and a location to prepare for and be excited about something. But I don't know that anyone's going to be too upset for too long. Everyone's probably past it. There are other things to get excited about in Miami, like windsurfing.
That, and we're still hosting a big party. We're hosting the Super Bowl soon, so that's at least something to get excited about. The Miami Herald's David Smiley again talking to us about Miami is not going to host the DNC. That's all right, but still Miami an important place for Democrats and Republicans before the 2020 election. David, always a pleasure, man. Thanks
Great
so much.
Great to be here. Yeah.
Still to come, what does it mean to be a genius? We're going to learn from a new group called the Genius 100. They're here in Miami with a special concert celebrating their newest member, a local conductor. All coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial, again from the studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. I'm Luis Hernandez. Our associations with the word genius often have to do with intellect or superior intelligence. Merriam-Webster defines it as a person endowed with extraordinary mental superiority. There's a new group called the Genius 100 that's expanding our idea of the word. The word of visionaries include actress Barbara Streisand, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Shimon Peres, former president of Israel. The group of 100 collaborated and shared their visions for the future in the world's first 3D book titled Genius, 100 Visions. Maestro Eduardo Martude leads the Miami Symphony Orchestra. He's officially introduced to the Genius 100 community today in a special concert on Albert Einstein's 140th birthday. We have details about the show in Miami's Design District on our social media, WLRN Sundial. He joins us now from the downtown studios. Maestro Martude, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The pleasure's all mine.
So you were inducted into the Genius 100 last fall, actually, but what does it mean for you to be part of this group?
Well, I tell you what, it's very special, and I can't still believe it, because if you look at the list, they are there together with Deepak Chopra, Barbara Streisand, Shimon Peres, as you said, I mean, the list is endless and so many important people. And, well, as a Miamian, I feel very flattered, very privileged. And I also believe the organization, which is growing and is stretching out, it has a lot to say. So I'm also very proud because I think we can change many things, which is very, very much the object of the organization, to change the world. I know it sounds a bit ambitious and arrogant, but that's the vision that they have with all of us put together.
You grew up in Caracas, Venezuela. And
indeed.
Yeah, and you started your journey into classical music there before then going to Cambridge to continue your studies. Tell us a little bit about the differences in the way it's music is performed, classical is performed, and how it's trained in Europe compared to Latin America.
That's a very interesting question, actually, because in Europe, one has to make the big difference between English education and, for example, continental French education. I was able to be left free of studying music in Cambridge, although I was somehow a latecomer because I graduated at 18 from science high school. And the English have this very openness about practicing, learning, studying, and performing music. Whereas the French, no offense intended, they're much more stiff in that, look, if you are not the right age, you cannot do it. And in Venezuela, we have somehow adopted that philosophy.
Yeah.
That's why I couldn't actually study music in Venezuela when I was older than I should have been. And in that way, in that sense, England opened everything for me, and thanks to their mentality, I will be ever grateful to them for that.
What made you decide to come back to, it was, what, 1979, you came back to Venezuela?
Yes, it was 1979, and I came back because they were asking me to conduct a new orchestra that they were opening there, and it was a great opportunity, besides, of course, going back home. And at that time, the famous El Sistema by Abreu that developed and got and grew so much was just beginning to make international effects. So I also parted and worked with Abreu on it. In fact, I conducted the first concert of the youth orchestra, and it was very, very exciting, I must say.
At what point did you know that you had to leave your home country and start traveling? And I'm wondering, what brought you to Miami?
Well, I was traveling so much all over the world, guest conducting, that my wife complained and said, "Look, listen, we live in a suitcase. We better settle down somewhere." And Maestro Ochoa, yes, and Maestro Manuel Ochoa, who was the founder of Miami Symphony, said, "Why don't you come here and be my successor? I'm old now. I need a, follow up." And but Miami for me was a vacation destination. I had a home in Miami for the last 40 years. I never thought of Miami as a place to work, but rather a place to come and enjoy, go to the beach. But when I came and I saw Ochoa, I saw what he'd done, I fell in love with the project. That was 14 years ago, and I decided, okay, let's do it. As long as the board supports me to make it into an orchestra that deserves the name of the city, because Miami is a big name for an orchestra, right? And I think within 10 years, we managed to reserve that name now. I'm happy and proud for it.
And, you know, because you just said, I mean, you saw Miami as a place where you could just play and have fun. What changed your perspective?
Well, having to raise money.
That's a good reason.
Yes, because the government, the state funds given to us, although they are very good and mean a lot, they're never going to cover everything. The box office, neither. It doesn't cover the cost. So we have to be very creative. And that's why the orchestra has turned into a kind of profile very different to other orchestras in the States, because we have to be Miami and cater for the Miamians. And in that, I think we've been very successful, because the orchestra is very much a reflection of its own community.
Again, talking with Maestro Eduardo Martorell of the Miami Symphony Orchestra. Martorell will be officially inaugurated into the group, the Genius 100. This is a group of award-winning actors, Nobel Prize winners, and artists, all part of a special performance happening in Midtown Miami tonight. And we have more details on our social media, WLRN Sundial. You know, you continue to have close ties to Venezuela, still with the youth orchestra. And, I mean, look, the country has been through so much, and the country's been through its nationwide blackouts. We've seen the violence, the upheaval in the streets. You know, as you watch this from here, what is your concern for the impact that it's going to have on that next generation of musicians?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, most of them have actually left the country already. I have quite a few of them in the orchestra playing. But the next generation, I have great faith in my country. And whatever is happening now, although it sounds terrible, is the door, the way to get out of what we had. We had to go through what we're going through now because it had to somehow clean itself of all these murderers, criminals, narco tyranny that we have. Somehow the world has not understood, or maybe too late, is that we have been taken hostage by Cuba, by the Castro regime, for many years. And somehow the world wasn't aware of it at the extent that it's aware now. Now they know. And in fact, now that the oil has been taken away from Cuba, it's shown how badly Cuba needed us, because now they're in big problem as well. So this is all a continental issue, which, by the way, I said it openly in one of my concerts recently. I thank and I recognize the United States government to being the first country that supported Venezuela's democracy. And we have really, and after that was Canada. And we have to really to thank you guys and acknowledge it, because if it wasn't for you, it would have been a very different story at the moment.
Tell me how art and music especially can help people in a time like this.
You know, that's the key factor, I believe, for youth, because there are so many distractions, there's so many stimulus that can take you anywhere you like, but with the digital era. But at the same time, it will take you very easily off from your center of your spirit. It's very easy to get distracted, even from school and from whatever, you know, from the focus of your life. And I think art and music have this amazing advantage, because it's the simplicity of a sound or the simplicity of a story that is right there for you to focus and concentrate on. And I think that's unique, much better than any computer, than any other input that you may have, or any modern input that we know or our young people simply adore, for starting with the cell phone, of course.
Yeah. You know what, as I mentioned before, today is obviously, Albert Einstein's 140th birthday, and this is all part of, the Genius 100 group celebrating you. What can you tell us about tonight's performance?
Tonight we are doing a concert called The Mystery of Genius. And my repertoire, what I've chosen, is very much to reflect on that mystery, how and where you find it. Also, I'm focusing on young talent. Why? Because it was very clear that they chose me to be one of the 100 geniuses because of my work with Miami Symphony in giving young artists, young talent, an opportunity to perform, to be discovered. So I'm showing quite an interesting number, a list of young performers, just to show what are we doing. We have a pianist, Brandon Goldberg, 12-year-old pianist, who is an absolute genius. And we have three singers or a guitar player, different, of course, my concert master playing on the violin that came out of the Holocaust from Auschwitz. Imagine, they've been lent to us to play this concert. He's going to play, Daniel and I, my concert master, going to play the Schindler's List on this amazing violin. So it's a whole combination of many different programs, of course, classical music too. We're going to play. It's going to be very exciting. If you have a chance to come, you're going to really love it. I recommend it.
You know what? Let me end on this real quickly, because one of the things that the Genius 100 is doing is they have this book that's coming out.
Yes.
Actually, it came out this past fall, detailing the vision of the future. And, you know, everybody who's part of the group gets to take part in this. What does your vision of the future look like?
Well, in the book, my vision relates to how we can help the human brain by inducing meditation with some mathematical techniques which I've learned. That's one part. The other part is the use of crystals in healing, we are much too bombarded by chemicals in our body, and crystals can be an amazing option to clean your system and to cure yourself. And finally, of course, the awareness that we are forgetting a basic principle. We think we have inherited the world ourselves, and that's not true. We have borrowed the world from our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I know this has been said many times.
Yeah.
In fact, it's an American Indian proverb, I believe. But this is something that has to be practiced more and more and more often. The future is theirs, and we are here to make sure they have it healthy and solid.
It's a lovely way to end the segment. Maestro Eduardo Martorey of the Miami Symphony Orchestra, he will officially be inaugurated into the group of the Genius 100 with other award-winning actors, Nobel Prize winners, and artists. We have more information about that group and, again, about the concert tonight, the performance tonight at Midtown Miami. You can find us at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Maestro Martorey, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's all mine. Thank you so much.
All right, still to come. Have you been to La Placita, the Puerto Rican restaurant on Biscayne? We're going to learn more about that popular spot coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, if you travel up Biscayne Boulevard into Miami's Upper East Side or scroll through your Instagram feed, it's possible you've seen this massive Puerto Rican flag mural. It's the face of the Puerto Rican restaurant La Placita that opened in January and has been packed with customers ever since. Thousands have come to dine on its authentic Puerto Rican dishes and, of course, to take selfies outside with this giant flag. But the City of Miami's Historic and Environmental Preservation Board voted last week 5-3 against granting a permit that would allow for the Puerto Rican flag to stay. The next City Commission meeting where their appeal could be heard is April 11th. Now, we spoke with the CEO and president of La Placita, Joey Cancel, about a few weeks ago, and we talked about the popularity of the restaurant and their ongoing fight about this mural. We also got perspective from Cancel on Puerto Rico's ongoing recovery from Hurricane Maria. He was formerly the president of the Puerto Rican Economic Development Bank.
How do you define what La Placita is and what you're trying to do here?
It's a totally Puerto Rican cuisine restaurant, and our expectation is to bring to every Puerto Rican in Miami the Puerto Rican food that they were trying to get from any other part without having to travel to Puerto Rico.
The restaurant made a lot of news right away because you have this giant mural of the Puerto Rican flag. Who was behind that decision to do that? Why did you do it?
When we were talking about how to deploy the concept, we said that we want to make a statement. And we took very much care on the inside of the restaurant and try to get all these vibrant colors and Puerto Rican type of ambience. But at some point, with the help of Julian Hill, which is one of our investors, he's part of that movement with artist Hector Collazo. And he was the one bringing to the table that idea of how about if we paint the flag on the building? Because this artist, it's doing that in Puerto Rico by a movement called 78 Towns Under One Flag. And now that movement evolved into mainland being called Plantando Bandera. So we were amazed by that idea. And we even brought the landlord to it. And he said, listen, if it's going to be for making more profits, I'm all the way in. So we made it happen.
And obviously it's become a popular spot. If anything, just to get the picture, it's become very Instagrammable, I guess is the word. I mean, what's it been like? What kind of, you know, how often do you see people out there taking a picture? Have you talked to them ever before, you know, what their stories are?
We've got the experience of getting people from all over the world that they are now, they want to have that picture here with the flag, and they come either from North U.S., the Northeast, or even from other parts of the world, like Spain. We have people from Spain saying, like, listen, we're here in Miami, and we got to take that photo from the Puerto Rican flag. We've been even invited to other states in mainland to continue evolving the concept and to remake this concept into the next Placita and the next Puerto Rican flag in a building. We're talking about Texas, we're talking about Tampa, we're talking about New York, we're talking about even Chicago, where great Puerto Rican communities are already present.
There was some controversy. I mean, the city said, hold on, you didn't get the permits, you might have to take it down. Where is that conversation right now? Has that been resolved?
Yeah, I gotta say that was a loophole in the process, and someone dropped the ball. But we're people of order. We like to comply. We like to be in full compliance with everything as we are right now. And unfortunately, some people say that we didn't have the permit. That's totally incorrect. We painted that flag in the presence of police officers and having the mayor, Francis Suarez, coming in to see the project developing. If we were doing that without a permit, that would be totally illegal and someone's gonna get arrested. That didn't happen. So we did have a permit. That was not the perfect permit due to a process that we are not the ones in charge of it, perhaps, but that loophole was generated and now we're complying with it. Right now we are in, we submitted all the information, renderings, pictures, everything to support our application for the certificate of appropriateness. And now we are waiting for the city to let us know a yay or a nay.
Just out of curiosity, if they say nay, are you prepared for that? What would happen next?
You know that we are prepared for that too. At the end, for every situation, there's an exception. I come from banking and there's policies, there's procedures, but there are objectives. And once you're aiming at the objective, exceptions can be considered. And we're talking here about a bunch of alternatives that we have to work along with the city to make this compliant and to integrate the community, to integrate the other businesses, and to continue moving forward with our plan. And the plan is economic development. What we're trying to do here is to invest, generate income, create jobs, and get this boulevard more vibrant than ever before. Right now, if you look at our neighbors in terms of businesses, they're closed down. There used to be a flower shop. This hotel up front is still in renovation. It's partially renovated, but not functioning. We have another building on the other side, the 67th Street, completely vacant. We are doing the opposite. We're investing. We're creating jobs. People around, they like this because this was, you know, suffering from a little depression.
Let's talk about the menu because, that was the big part of it, is to make it genuine. Genuine Puerto Rican. So tell us a little bit about what's on the menu, what is unique to the restaurant, and, I'd imagine you've heard from Puerto Ricans who say, okay, I feel like I'm at home, or are you hearing that?
Totally. Starting from the beginning, yeah, the menu is 100% Puerto Rican. Creations by Chef Jose Mendin, which is 100% Puerto Rican too. And from the last 20 years or more, has been relocated here in Miami, and learning from every other cuisine infusions and so. As Puerto Rican as yourself, you know that the eternal battle with the Dominicans is in regards to el mofongo. Mangú for them, mofongo for us. Who is the best? Who make the best plantain mofongo? So in that quest, that's like the main dish in our menu. And that has a lot of other alternatives, from lechon asado, down to bacalaitos, alcapurrias, everything that you as a Puerto Rican know that is tasteful, that you, once you got it, you really go back, like in the Ratatouille movie, go back in time and you go and say, oh my God, this is just like la abuelita. El arroz con habichuela, el arroz con gandules, los pasteles, everything that it's not translatable. You say here pasteles and people go like, oh, what is that? And you guys say, well, it's like a tamal, but it's not. So you got to come here and have the experience. And I hope you can go and fly to Puerto Rico and then compare that and say, listen, I got that experience in Miami. The same rice and beans, the same mofongo that I tasted in Puerto Rico.
You're listening to a conversation we had with Joey Cancel, CEO and president of the Puerto Rican restaurant La Placita. The restaurant has faced controversy for its mural of a Puerto Rican flag that was not approved by the city's Historic Preservation Board. Cancel is talking about their fight with the city, the restaurant's authentic food offerings, and the connections to his home country still recovering from Hurricane Maria. Let's return to the conversation.
You come from the banking side, as you mentioned, and back in 2013, then-Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla appointed you as the president of the Economic Development Bank of Puerto Rico. I mean, first of all, how do you go from that world, and now you're in this one? That's a massive transition. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because of family. I have a good friend, which is Jorge Mendin Sr. He is Jose Mendin's father. And I know Jorge for more than 15 years now. And when the business was evolving and going through changes, he requested me. It was an invitation. He said, like, I need you in Miami tomorrow. And I cannot say no to my dear friend Jorge. So I just packed and came here on the 26th of December 2017. And since then, I've been like back and forth until I fully relocated here. And now we're on a deeply comprehensive expansion plan with new investors, and business is booming. I gotta say that I'm grateful for this opportunity, and managing the business side of these creative owners such as Jose Mendin and Sergio Navarro, it's been great. It's been a roller coaster, and sky's the limit.
You have such a deep understanding of Puerto Rico, its economics, its politics. And we knew all the trouble that the island was in before Hurricane Maria. But, I mean, how do you describe to people who don't know or don't understand that what Puerto Rico's been going through over the last 10, 20 years?
Well, it's a really complex financial and now infrastructural situation. For people that don't know Puerto Rico, I gotta say in a few words that it's the last colony of the United States, and as a U.S. territory, we have all the benefits when it comes to citizenship and when it comes to having, you know, all the U.S. protection, but we lack of other, you know, privileges as voting for the president. And it's a really complex definition of what we are. I resume it as a colony because it's already like stated by the Supreme Court, but it's not a state, it's a commonwealth. It's an island, but it's not part of the continent. So, long story short, I think that Puerto Rico, it's now on the really verge of a change when it comes to its politics and the way it's going to be managed from this point forward, due to the fact that there is a fiscal control board right now ruling over Puerto Rico. And that is a game changer when it comes to how Commonwealth finances and the development plan is going to be deployed along with the oversight of the Congress. So it is a changing environment inside out of Puerto Rico right now.
And then after Hurricane Maria, I mean, how do you describe what, and you go back from time to time, what it's been more than a year, but how's the recovery? How are people doing? A lot of people left. Are they coming back?
Well, the recovery has been really slow when it comes to other states with big environmental situations, such as in New Orleans and Katrina and other ones. The recovery has been really, really slow. And now the latest information is that President Trump is redirecting funds that were destined for recovery, building the wall program. So that will also hurt Puerto Rico recovery in a timely manner or timely fashion. So I think that we had a financial hurricane first, and then came a environmental hurricane. Those two together have, you know, placed Puerto Rico like 10 years behind, and all that diaspora or people going outside of Puerto Rico to relocate and to search for alternatives, jobs, and a better quality of life is uncertain. Well, maybe the government must do whatever it takes to attract those talents. back to the island. Because it's a simple fact. When us Puerto Ricans, as being U.S. citizens, we can travel to the U.S. only by our license, driver's license. So engineers, architects, CPAs, they have their credentials and their their licenses to go into the States and continue having a job and enforce their professions. So that becomes an alternative, and even doctors, the same thing. So that becomes a bridge to get all of these well-prepared professionals outside of Puerto Rico.
Let me finish with this. I'd imagine from time to time you run into Puerto Ricans who had to leave because of the hurricane, and they come here, and I'd picture, and look, I this brings back memories too, is that this has to be special for them. It's a taste of home, and bring, you know, it's comfortable. But I wonder how many times you run into people, what do they tell you? What kind of stories they tell you?
Yeah, indeed. As you described, that taste of home, it's every day resembled, every day, you know, highlighted. They like the feeling of the warmth. Most of our servers are Puerto Rican, and they feel like they're in a little place of Puerto Rico here in Miami.
That was Joey Cancel, president and CEO of La Placita. You can see photos of our trip to La Placita and read more about the controversy facing that mural at our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for today, this Thursday, March 14th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful Thursday. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.